And welcome to the Friday edition of a Juno Afternoon here on 104.3 KTOO FM in Juno. I'm Andy Klein, your host today. Today we're going to be talking to Forrest Wagner and Ben Huff, both of UAS. They're doing different classes. Forrest is doing a first responder class and Ben Huff a photography class out at UAS. Maria Lovishev is going to be here, and Andrea Campbell will also be here to highlight this year's Empty Bowls fundraiser for the Glory Hole. Sorry, Maria, for butchering your name. Irene Morris will be here as well to tell us about Saturday's Earth Day celebration, and Sarah Brown will be here to talk about Juno's Symphony Showcase that's coming up this weekend. Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and more. It's all happening here on a Juno Afternoon.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Virginia's Pamunkey tribe was dealt a setback in its effort to gain federal recognition by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Matt Laszlo has the details on how civil rights groups and a big casino may be winning the centuries-old fight of the Pamunkey.
Everyone knows Pocahontas, but do you know what tribe she hails from? Virginia's Pamunkey Indians claim her as an ancestor. While Pocahontas and the Pamunkey have roots that predate the nation's founding, the tribe isn't recognized by the federal government because their records were destroyed early last century because a Virginia policy declared only two races, white and black.
This is an outrageous injustice. These are the Indian tribes that enabled the original English settlers to survive.
That's former Virginia Congressman Jim Moran, who has advocated for federal recognition of the Pamunkey for nearly two decades. Last week, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was supposed to decide on the tribe's status, but under pressure from critics, they moved the deadline. A group of five female lawmakers asked the Bureau to look into claims of gender discrimination in the tribe, while members of the Congressional Black Caucus, including Virginia Democrat Bobby Scott, are asking the Bureau to look into other allegations.
The allegation is that some of the tribes may have racially discriminatory policies, and it'd be inappropriate to give them federal recognition. And if that's not true, then it's not true, but the allegations deserve a review.
Then there are casinos. MGM officials fear federal recognition could bring gambling to Southern Virginia, which could imperil their casino venture in Maryland. Virginia Republican Morgan Griffith says MGM shouldn't have any say.
There's a billionaire casino. Wait a minute. Does he live in Virginia? Why is he opposed to it? Well, he's opposed to it because he doesn't want competition. That isn't why you should make a decision on whether a tribe ought to be recognized or not.
Professor Gregory Smithers, an expert on Native Americans at Virginia Commonwealth University, says it's difficult to say how many Virginians can trace their ancestry back to the tribe.
From the arrival of Europeans in the 17th century, there was intermarriage between European men and Native Americans all up and down the eastern seaboard. The Pamunkey were no different.
There was also intermarriage with freed or escaped slaves. And then, in the early 20th century, Virginia law made it impossible for many to claim Native status.
If you have one drop of black blood, you're not Native American, you're not Pamunkey, you're not Nottoway, you're African American, and therefore you cease to exist as a Pamunkey.
Modern-day tribal leaders claim about 200 members, but the professor says if the federal government were to recognize the Pamunkeys, more might come forward.
There are many Virginians who claim a connection back to Pocahontas and the Powhatan at the time of contact with the English.
The Pamunkey signed a treaty with the British in 1658, giving them a reservation in Virginia, but much of their land was taken away in subsequent centuries. The Bureau of Indian Affairs moved its deadline for a ruling until the end of July. I'm Matt Laszlo.
A youth summit is scheduled to take place on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota Saturday. Jim Kent has more on what Native youth can look forward to doing.
Lakota Children's Enrichment founder and CEO Maggie Dunn says this weekend's youth summit on Pine Ridge is calling all takers from 11 to 25.
There'll be t-shirts, art projects, and one of our youth advisory board members is leading a project to build community gardens.
If you're not down for growing plants or food, Maggie Dunn says exploring other talents might bring you home, like spoken word and poetry workshops. Jasmine Manns, writer and poet who travels the world sharing her words, will run a workshop. Manns says developing the ability to share their thoughts and feelings through words is perhaps the most valuable tool Lakota youth can be given.
Once they know that they have a voice, then they can use that to create change and to defend themselves and to defend the people that they love.
Manns adds that once Lakota youth know they can articulate their thoughts, they can communicate with the world. I'm Jim Kent.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Mm-hmm.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support by NativeGiving.org, empowering Native children and families through community giving.
All the donations made on NativeGiving.org go toward the organization you choose.
Information on successful innovations at NativeGiving.org.
Science, technology, engineering, and math students thrive at New Mexico Tech. Personalized instruction, rigorous curricula, undergrad research opportunities. New Mexico Tech, where the smart kids go. Info in Winds of Change magazine or visit nmt.edu. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
I'm a real wild one.
Wild one.
Wild one.
Wild one. Wild one. Wild one.
Well, if you're a wild one and get out there and want to get out in the wilderness, you're going to want to hear the next segment here. And also, if you're out there and out and about or wherever you might be and want to learn more about photography, we've got a couple of folks right now. From UAS, Forrest Wagner is here, and Ben Huff is here. Forrest Wagner is doing the upcoming ODS Wilderness First Responder class. And Ben, you have a UAS summer photography class coming up. So welcome to both of you for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So since we've talked about Wild One first here, Forrest, tell me a little bit about what people can expect if they want to hear and find out more information about your class. And
thanks, Andy. Yeah, so we actually, this is the recertification for the 10-day Wilderness First Responder, which is running at a different time. That'll be next year in March. This is the 3-day 24-hour class. It meets Friday, April 24th through Sunday, April 26th. It's a one-credit 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. offering that recertifies people with the 80-hour course. And this is the industry standard for wilderness first aid. So that helps people get jobs. It also is kind of a good baseline for understanding how to patch folks up and get them out of the backcountry to kind of a advanced life support, EMT, or ambulance response. And I personally had this certification for about 15 years. It's something that once you lose it, you have to spend significantly more time to get back. Mm-hmm. The recert is this sort of like special group of people in this very outdoor-oriented community that come together to keep this WFR Wilderness First Responder current. And I just wanted to kind of let the community know that we still have a few seats open. And if they wanted to sign up, they can contact me at the university at 907-796-6361 or Kaya Day, the Humanities Administrative Assistant, 907-796-6405. But we do have a few seats open still. It's going to be a really good class. It's normally one that, you know, we're pretty proud to host.
Cool. Let's talk a little bit more about what goes into it. But Ben, just turn to you first, and give me a little summary about what you're going to be covering in your photography course.
Yeah. So the photography course is a beginning photography course, and it's really similar to the fall and spring course that we have taught every semester for several years now. We just last semester opened up a summer course. We typically have a waiting list in the fall and the spring, and it's usually a one night a week course for 3 hours in the evening, What's really great, I think, about the summer course is they're longer days. It's only 6 weeks. It's 9 a.m. to 2:45 Tuesday and Thursday, so it's a big chunk of time. But the thing that we don't really do in the fall and the spring, being a night course and with the weather and the light, is we do lecture and it's sort of lab, and we do printing and there's critique and sort of everything that would be involved in a basic photography course. But what's great about this summer course is we start off with lecture, and then we actually go out into the field and we make pictures together, and then we use what's great about digital technology and coming back and viewing those photos and having some critique and having some good sort of camaraderie in the class. And it's last summer was the first summer that we did it, and it was great. I'm looking forward to it again this summer, and just sort of similar to Forrest, just want to let the public know that we're doing it, and it's relatively new, and we're excited about it. It's coming up. It starts May 19th through June 25th, so just we have about a week and a half between closing up for the fall semester and then getting going for the summer.
And in the summer semester, are the chunks of time, I'm assuming, are kind of different than what they are in normal semesters? Do you have a longer class time?
For sure, kind of thing? Yeah. So right now, for instance, the spring course, it's a Wednesday night for 3 hours, 5:30 to 8:30. This is Tuesday and Thursday from 9 a.m. to 2:45. So it's a commitment, and we cover a lot of ground, and it's intense, but it's fun.
It sounds like a really cool learning environment, though, right? To really dive in for multiple hours on a couple of days a week.
We're right there in Whitehead, you know, so we'll do some lecture and then head right out the back door. You know, Hawk Lake is there and the trails are there, and we have so much right at arm's length that we can, you know, get out and make pictures. If the weather's bad, then we hang out inside and work with available light or do exercises inside. So it's great.
And as you said, technology has changed that field so much. And I'm sure that's the same for your field as well. I would think that in first responding, there's things that have really changed it from, you know, field is a field where technology hasn't changed things much. You still got to use ropes and sticks and stuff like that to splint up a broken leg or, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that's the main difference. We don't have advanced life support in the backcountry. Technology is interesting in outdoor sports and adventure sports because this recertification for the WFR, it's really kind of about decision making and assessing a problem and finding a solution that's more or less a temporary fix to transport people back to kind of front country setting where there is obviously a lot of advances in science and technology that can make people kind of stay alive longer or get better faster. But for us, it's updated regularly, this curriculum of wilderness medicine, but it's primarily dealing with trauma and not making anything worse. Wilderness medicine happens at the skin level, so it's actually very slow. This is not like, you know, ER sort of fast-paced. But where science and technology is really interesting in outdoor studies is with the kind of advent of things like avalanche transceivers, and similarly to with the seatbelt, you know, whether or not that actually changes how people perceive risk and how we actually engage with the outdoor landscape. And
it certainly seems like there's a higher risk. There's some higher risk activities that are more commonplace now.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the backcountry is more accessible than it's ever been.
Right.
You know, we have good or better touring skis, and this isn't just this sort of like minimum impact camping trend of the more environmentally inclined 1970s. This is actually in a commodified sense. This is like REI wants people to buy apparel because it's sort of sexy to go outside, and a lot more people are doing that. And so things like the Wilderness First Responder are just good baselines as a skill set. I mean, in Ben's classes, when he goes more remotely, having a woofer on, you know, within his general group would be a good risk management plan. And it's also kind of like the EMT. This is sort of the equivalent sort of wilderness first aid in the field, so it's universal. You know, it's across the world. There's internationally the same class, the same curriculum, and it's a little more than just CPR and basic first aid. It's a lot more of kind of like working together in a small group and taking care of basic things like airway and breathing and circulation.
Sure,
and again, these sort of like decision-making tools that are taught in the full-length class are reviewed. People are assessed again to be at this certification. But if anything, it reiterates what's taught in the longer class in a more meaningful way with people that are clearly using this professionally.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes for a really enjoyable three-day sort of intensive, similar to Ben's classes, intensive 8-to-5 class session. But then it's over, and you don't need to do it again for 2 to 3 years. And
you're prepared. You know,
and you're prepared. Yeah, you're kind of like you re-remember all that information that you ideally didn't have to use.
Right.
And that's nice too. I mean, you're not like most wilderness first responders are not EMTs or paramedics. We're people that like being outside that needed this certification to get a job, and then it became more than a job, and then you actually had to use it, and you're like, well, how? And there's some interesting things about it.
Yeah.
You can reduce dislocations and administer epinephrine and things that you're not really doing in the front country with the kind of equivalent front country wilderness first aid or first aid, you know, basically responder level training. So, yeah.
Well, Ben, in your class, what can people do? People kind of build a portfolio through this? Can they expect to walk away with a collection that reflects a whole bunch of different styles? Or what's kind of your goals for the students?
For sure. I mean, it's a pretty comprehensive class, right? I mean, it starts very technical, right? I mean, it very much starts aperture and shutter speed and what's ISO and what are all these things, color balance and white balance. What does all this mean, right? I have this camera. I don't know how to use it very well, right? I'm familiar with the you know, my iPhone or whatever it is. I have this DSLR. I have a camera that has manual functions. Like, what does this mean, right? So it's sort of first dealing with that and sort of demystifying that and making it a little less scary, I think. Then dealing with Photoshop and doing sort of the similar thing there and breaking down that really powerful beast into really small fundamental things that you really need to know, and then sort of letting the other stuff simmer for a bit, right? And then focusing on editing and focusing on narrative. And obviously we talk a lot about light and about composition. And then from a portfolio standpoint, we have printers as well, photo printers. So, and we're actually this semester, this will be the first semester, the summer semester, where we're sort of dismantling the digital lab, our printing lab, and pulling all of that, all those printers and that sort of network into the regular classroom, which will make that scenario much, much easier to teach in. It'll be really wonderful. And at the end of the semester, we have, like for this class on Wednesday night, this next Wednesday, they'll have a 15-picture digital edit, which will show on the screen in class as part of their final that they'll present in the Egan Lecture Hall.
Oh,
so they'll
cool.
turn down the lights. And then they have two prints due from that 15-piece edit that will hang in the Soboloff building and have sort of a little closing exhibition celebration, and we sort of will do that every semester. So the summer semester we'll do the same thing. So you'll have sort of
a
cohesive digital edit, and
right.
then you'll have physical prints to walk away with as
That's
well.
That's great.
Yeah.
Wow, that sounds exciting. All right, well, just one more time, remind people how they can find out more information or how to get a hold of you or who they need to get a hold of in order to get these courses.
Yeah, thanks, Andy. So this is the Wilderness First Responder Recertification. It's ODS PE 122. It's one credit. It's running April 24th through 26th. That's next Friday through Sunday at UAS and at the Rec Center in room 115. If you want to sign up, you can do so online, or you can call us at UAS at 907-796-6361. That's me, Forrest Wagner, Outdoor Studies, or Kaya Day, the Administrative Assistant to the Humanities, at 907-796-6405. The class costs $374 in total, so that's the credit plus associated fees, and we do have seats.
Great, yeah. And Ben, yeah.
Yep, it's on the UAS schedule. It's ART 222. It's Tuesday, Thursday, May 19th through June 25th, 9 a.m. to 2:45. All of my information is there online. Personal email is ben@hufffoto.com. Ask questions. By all means, if you're listening right now, shoot me an email. I'll get back to you here in the next few minutes, and we'll get it going.
That's great, Ben Huff, Forrest Wagner. Thanks both
thanks,
of you for coming
Andy.
In.
Thank you very much
for your class. It sounds like fun. We started with Wild Child, so we'll end with Photograph.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
Hit them both.
Light.
And welcome back to a Juno Afternoon, where Maria Lovashuk and Andrea Campbell have joined me here to talk a little bit about the Empty Bowls fundraiser for the Glory Hole. Happens every year, always such a great event. And Maria, first off, welcome to both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for having us, Cindy.
And tell me, just so people know, just a little refresher, just kind of the mission in general of the Glory Hole. What kinds of things are you trying to accomplish every day and every year?
So our mission is to provide food, shelter, and compassion to those most in need. And so we serve breakfast, lunch, and dinner and provide 40 beds of emergency shelter. And we also have other programs, like we have a laundry program, we help people find jobs or housing, we have a garden program that's actually kind of getting into the swing right now, except for it's snowing.
Yeah, but, I know, except for the hail. It's the weirdest weather lately, yeah.
The hardiest plants will survive.
Yes.
so that's basically what we do.
Okay, well, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure most of people listening are familiar, but it's always really nice to hear the mission, and I always love hearing the actual mission statement. It's always a really meaningful statement. But Andrea, you're helping put together this event, Empty Bowls, and
I am. This is my first year being the event coordinator for Empty Bowls. So we've been busy procuring auction items and donors and sponsorships. That's a lot of work that goes into it.
Tell me the date and all that first of all, and then how people maybe can get involved, or if you're still looking for items and things like that.
It's going to be 5 p.m. Sunday, April 26th. It's at Centennial Hall. Tickets are $30. You can get them either at Hearthside Books or at the door. And as it stands, we are still looking for sponsors. So if you are interested in being a sponsor, you can contact Maria at the Glory Hole. And she can pass your information on to me.
Great. And tell me about the event itself. What can people expect when they go?
It's really fun.
Yeah. I mean, I've been.
It's awesome. So this is the best soup year we've had so far. So the local restaurants donate soups. And so this year we have like close to 17 restaurants donating soups, which
That's
is
great.
Awesome. So pretty much like every restaurant has donated soups. And we're having tons of bread from Breezen, unlimited cookies, a really, really great dessert
option. Unlimited
auction.
Cookies. And stop the presents.
And unlimited soup and unlimited bread with butter.
It's amazing. Yeah. And then tell me about how, but it's about bowls too, right? It's about the bowls themselves. So how does that kind of work for people who haven't been?
We have local artists who create these bowls and then donate them to the event. And they're beautiful bowls. I still have mine from last year. Last year was the first year I went. And it's something you would find at, you know, any of the stores downtown. Very beautiful, well-crafted bowls.
Different materials, or mostly pottery or
pottery
ceramics?
And wood. Like Neil Slotnick and Dan Gottschall made beautiful bowls out of like local ash, I think, where's like some cedar and spruce and some stuff from up north from the Yukon. They're beautiful.
Nice.
Yeah.
So tell me just a few of the artists that kind of help with the bowls.
Well, UAS and The Canvas are the biggest bowl contributors, and we're just so grateful to Brandon and to Jeremy for doing that. And then the Tungus Woodturners and Don Gottschall and Neil Slotnick do a lot of wooden stuff. And then the Walkers family just produce amazing, beautiful stuff, and they bring like 70 to 80 bowls every year.
That's really
incredible.
Cool. Such a great thing, a real outpouring of people being just very generous.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really amazing because pretty much like everybody donates something. Like everybody, you know, it's either a silent auction item or a soup or cookies. I mean, it really is amazing how many people contribute to this event.
Tell me just a little bit more about how long does it go? Is there music? There's auctions happening, all that kind of stuff, right?
There is music. There is Ursa Minor and Full Circle Music in the lobby.
And then we also have a silent auction going on. So there's going to be a lot going on within about 2 hours, so from 5 to 7 p.m.
Okay, yeah.
And I think we figured out the line situation last year.
Was there a longer line? Yeah.
It was a shorter line,
and
it moved a lot faster because we have two food stations. And so you don't have to spend the 2 hours standing in line anymore.
Right.
Which is helpful, I think.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. Although, you know, good conversations happen in line, too.
And they carry the bread and the refreshments around. That's another addition.
Well, anything else you want to cover about the event, or just maybe one more time recap how people can get involved if they aren't already, and how people can get tickets and be involved in this really cool event, Empty Bowls?
Sure. So 5 p.m., Sunday, April 26th. Tickets are available at Hearthside Books or at the door. We are still looking for sponsors, so if you are interested or you know someone who is, please contact Maria at the Glory Hole, and her number is
586-4159, extension 2.
And this is this kind of the major fundraiser for the Glory Hole
every
year?
It's our only one, like, actual fundraiser.
Yeah, and
unless we have a flood again, at which point we'll have to have another
fundraiser. Let's not do that again. Well, thanks so much to both of you for coming in. Much appreciated. And we're going to hear next from Garrison Keillor. This is Writer's Almanac.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday, the 17th of April, 2015. It's the birthday of the writer who said, "My advice to you is not to inquire why or whither, but just enjoy your ice cream while it is on your plate." Thornton Wilder, born Madison, Wisconsin, 1897, father was a diplomat. Wilder and his four brothers and sisters moved back and forth between Asia and the United States, went to Oberlin, then to Yale, got a job teaching French at a boys' boarding school. In 1926, he spent the summer at McDowell Colony, Writer's Retreat in New Hampshire, and he started work on his new novel, The Bridge of San Luis Rey, set in the 18th century, story of a bridge that collapses in Lima, Peru, while five people are crossing it. The collapse witnessed by a Franciscan monk who becomes obsessed by it and tries to figure out why those five people had to die. Wilder finished it less than a year later. It was an immediate success, sold nearly 300,000 copies, which enabled him to quit his job and build a house for himself and his parents and his sisters in Hamden, Connecticut, which was his residence for the rest of his life. His plays were popular, especially Our Town and his play The Matchmaker, which was adapted into the musical Hello, Dolly. Somewhere every day, the play Our Town is being performed by somebody. And Emily says her line, "Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anybody to realize you. Do any human beings ever realize life while they live it every minute?" When he was 65, Thornton Wilder, famous writer, comfortable in Connecticut, busy being a literary man, he decided to escape from his own life and got in his Thunderbird convertible, drove west for 10 days. His car broke down in Arizona, just outside of Douglas, Arizona, and he got himself a hotel room, and he stuck around for almost a year and got started on a novel, which came out 4 years later, The Eighth Day, and it won a National Book Award. Here's a poem for today by Tom Hennen, Looking for the Differences. I am struck by the otherness of things rather than their sameness, the way a tiny pile of snow perches in the crook of a branch in the tall pine, away by itself, high enough not to be noticed by people, out of reach of stray dogs. It leans against the scaly pine bark, busy at some existence that does not need me. It is the difference of objects that I love that lift me toward the rest of the universe, that amaze me, that each thing on earth has its own soul, its own life, that each tree, each clod is filled with the mud of its own star. I watch where I step and see that the fallen leaf, old broken grass, and icy stone are placed in exactly the right spot on the earth, carefully, royalty in their own country. Looking for the Differences, a poem by Tom Hennen, from Darkness Sticks to Everything, published by Copper Canyon Press, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, Throughout the month of April, their favorite poem project, Florida, invites Floridians to submit their favorite poem. Florida-based listeners can submit their nominations at poetryfoundation.org/favoritepoemflorida. And by Progressive Insurance, working to make progress for more than 75 years. Produced by Joy Biles, assisted by Teresa Burgess, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Help finish the fight against cancer and join the American Cancer Society Relay for Life of Juneau event. Juneau's Relay for Life event takes place in June and involves a fun-filled 18-hour walk. Money raised helps individuals in every community receive free information and service while funding groundbreaking cancer research to save more lives. More information at relayforlifeofjuneau.org.
Marvin Gaye there, reminding us to take care of the ecology, and that's what Earth Day is all about. We've got a couple of folks next in the studio who are going to tell us all about what's happening on Saturday's Earth Day celebration. Irene Morris is here, and John Neary, thanks for both for coming in. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Irene, let's talk to you first. You've kind of been involved with Earth Day for years.
This is my 10th year of organizing it at the Glacier.
That's so awesome. Tell me a little bit about what's happened in past years and maybe what you're expecting this year.
Okay, well, in the past years, we've had very good support from a lot of nonprofits in town, and again, we will have that this year, coming out to share a little bit of whatever their organization does to help this planet and teach us how that we can do it. So we will have that again this year. We have a new theme this year, Driving the Rain, which in a moment I'll let John explain it because it's a wonderful theme for Juneau and the future of Juneau in our energy concern. So this year we will have some of the regulars. We're going to have the Belly Dancers, the Daughters of the New Moon.
Always fun.
Yes. And also the All Nations Children's Tlingit Children's Dancers will be here to open up at 10:30. The Daughters of the New Moon will be playing kind of towards the end at 2:30. And in between, we have some exceptional speakers dealing with our sustainability and sustainable energy. So we also have the Alaska Wildlife Association and AmeriCorps showing up with lots of children's activities.
Oh, that's
so it's a good day for children. It might be their first Earth Day. It'll make good impression on them, so they'll remember this day every year.
Now, why are you so committed to Earth Day?
Because I've been around, like John said, since the Earth was started. Actually, since the first Earth Day. The very first Earth Day, I was a sophomore in college, and I rode my bicycle up a very sharp incline in California to class, picking up cans along the way, and I joined the ecology club. I had a biology teacher that was the eco freak of San Luis Obispo County at Cal Poly, and so I was involved from the very beginning, and I truly believe that it is one day that we can actually stop and realize just the way it started, we can make a difference, each one of us, if we learn how we can do that. And that's what Earth Day is about, to learn how you can make a difference. And it doesn't have to be, it could be recycling, it could be planting trees, it could be energy consumption, lessening that. Anyway, there's something everybody can do every single day.
Yeah, cool. So, well, John, tell us a little bit about the focus, which this year is on transit.
Exactly, electric transit specifically, because as you might know, if you've ever been out to the Mendenhall Visitor Center on a Monday afternoon, we have a transit problem, which is, a lot of people, about 500,000 a summer, coming out to see their disappearing glacier. Glaciers are cool, right? And people want to see them before they disappear. So we have a transit issue. And as I start to think about that issue, the first thought was, okay, well, there could be some immediate solutions. We might be able to have, like, remote parking lots and a circulator that bring people down to quiet down that end of the road kind of zone. That would really help. But how do we do this really long term? And how do we then allow people to make the connection between their lifestyle and the fact that they are standing in front of a retreating glacier. How do we make that connection for them? So myself and a team of people actually recently went to a workshop. And at that workshop, we concluded that we really need to make a broader connection for the community of Juneau in our transit system, especially because electric vehicles are really starting to appear on the market now in a big way. You've probably seen them around town. And they represent a very interesting opportunity to reduce our consumption and use hydropower in a way that Juneau can brag about, because we have the cleanest hydropower on Earth. In many ways, you know, this high elevation lake storage that AELMP puts to use for us can really power our cars as well as much of our lifestyle.
It's amazing, really, when you think about that this town so largely runs on this very clean, you know, system. It's kind of amazing.
It is amazing. It's unique. In many places, hydropower is not necessarily the cleanest alternative. It interferes with the runs of salmon in the Bonneville, you know, in the Columbia River. So here we don't have that problem because we have these high elevation lakes. So the other part of that, too, is that the utility is worried about the winter load. It's a heating load for them. And so they're much interested in conserving energy in the winter, not so much in the summer, because they have extra capacity in the summer, right? And transit fits really nicely into that, because we got all these people coming into Juneau in the summer. They want transit. They're coming in on their cruise ship. So Duff Mitchell is going to be talking about, what about plugging in those cruise ships down at the docks?
Mm-hmm.
And Greg Fisk will be talking about, what about a circulator for downtown to decrease congestion down there? As well as me focusing on Mendenhall and what our issues are. We're also considering a circulator. We're considering electric vehicles in various ways, both with the tour fleet as well as with parking spots for people being favored if you're electric. For example, this weekend, if you come out to the visitor center for us at 10 o'clock and you have a combustion engine, you're going to have to park in the middle parking lot or further out the road because it's an EV-only zone out there at the end of the road.
Okay, yeah. Well, tell me just a little bit, wrap up a little bit more for me, how people can get involved, any other things you might want to cover about what's happening out there on Earth Day
on
Saturday.
Well, one thing, as John said, we do have all of these speakers that will be speaking, and we'll have a large array of different electrical vehicles, even boats. So, and he failed to mention Bill Leedy is coming too, which he is the, he's the planet manager.
He's going to open it up with a great talk.
Yeah, on sustainability. So, and he has all kinds of information on kilowatt hours, and he has a bicycle that will show you what kilowatt hours are.
Oh, another thing we're going to have is a film. I don't know if you've seen Revenge of the Electric Car.
I've heard about that film.
It's an awesome
film.
I've absolutely heard
about that film.
Yeah, it features Bob Lutz from GM and how he sort of saw the light about the Chevy Volt, and as well Elon Musk with Tesla. Some cool stuff, actually, in that film.
Yeah.
And so people can come out. They can get – and also we're going to have some of the conversion cars, which for people that think that an electric car would be far in their future because of the cost, is the other thing that they do have kits now. And so there are some Juneau citizens that have converted cars. So be out there to ask questions. There'll be a lot of people answering questions for everyone.
Well, very cool. Earth Day happening Saturday. When does it start?
10 o'clock in the morning till 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Great. 10 to 2 out at the Mendenhall Visitor Center. It's always beautiful to be out there. It's always a great excuse just to get out there and go enjoy our visitor center out there. It's such a beautiful spot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
and,
thanks.
Oh, may I also just add a pitch for the Juneau Freewheelers event that JPD is also sponsoring for cyclists, which starts downtown 1, but ends right about the time Earth Day is wrapping up at the Visitor Center at around 2 or so. So the ultimate transit, which is bicycles, people can take a ride from downtown and show up for the end of Earth Day at the Visitor Center.
Great. Thanks so much. John and Irene, thanks so much
for
coming
in.
Appreciate
it.
Now here next, here's Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. To a connoisseur, not all sugars taste the same. A hummingbird dips its long, slender bill into a scarlet, tube-shaped flower to reach the nectar deep within. When it flies off, the bird carries pollen from the plant, which it rubs off on the next flower from which it sips. Like some bees, hummingbirds specialize in nectar feeding and are essential pollinators. Even though they also eat tiny insects, they are the ultimate nectar connoisseurs. and the sugar they prefer and seek in flowers is sucrose. Other kinds of birds, less specialized to nectar, also visit flowers for a taste of the sweet stuff. The flowers they visit likely have a more open shape, with nectar more accessible to a non-specialist's bill. These birds may still be important pollinators, but the sugar they sample is likely different from what hummingbirds prefer. As flowering plants and birds co-evolved, each to benefit from the other, it seems likely that plants evolved the type of sugar best suited to the pollinators on hand, offering it in their flowers. It's a win-win for all concerned. The plants that need the birds, and the birds that want the sugar. But not just any sugar, the right sugar.
Support for this station comes from Alaska Canopy Tours, offering canopy and zipline tours. More information at alaskacanopy.com. Theater at Latitude 58 presents William Shakespeare's The Tempest, an exiled sorceress, a shipwreck, a magical island, spirits, love, hate, revenge, justice. Come experience the beauty of Shakespeare's final play, April 17th, 18th, and 19th at McTheaters Hall. Tickets are available on Vendini, at Hearthside Books, and at the door. We are such stuff as dreams are made on, and our little life is rounded with a sleep.
Welcome back to Juno Afternoon. I'm Andy Klein, and in the studio with me now is Richard Stokes and Sarah Isto. They're here to talk about a poetry reading that's happening this Sunday at the Downtown Library. Welcome, both of you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Well, tell me a little bit more. You were saying it's a specific reading group that's going to be then reading poetry as well.
Yeah, mainly it's going to be the Byrne Thompson writing group.
Yes.
That meets every 2 weeks. Right now we're meeting every other Wednesday from 5 to 7 at the Downtown Library. It remains to be seen whether the group will stick with that schedule all summer. In the past, we've sort of backed off a little bit during the summer months. But the reading itself is 2 to 4:30 at the Downtown Library on Sunday. There'll be readers from this group and also some invited guests. And if someone shows up with a poem that they want to read and time allows, I think that the sort of the coordinator of this has been Mary Lou Spartz, and who organized one of these last year that was pretty successful.
Well, tell me about, are the poems that are read, are they original poems? Are there some of them, or is there a mix? Or
no, they're all original poems. The Byrne Thompson group has people in it who write poetry and some who write prose. But this is going to be just poetry because it's April, poetry month.
Yes.
And there's no charge. There will be refreshments. And I think each person will be reading probably 3 or 4 poems, and
Is everyone reading their own?
Yes,
poetry?
Everyone is reading their own.
Yeah,
and so it's fun to hear an author read with the emphasis they had in mind.
I was going to say the same thing. It's often, I mean, it's actually interesting to hear both, isn't it? It's always, I think, interesting to hear how other people would interpret a poem as well. But it is really a nice thing to hear the author and hear the emphasis and you really get the full meaning that they're trying to convey often when they're reading it.
And it's a great opportunity for the writer because the writer gets some feedback, you know, during the process. You can see if people are dozing in their chair, if they're getting up to leave.
Well, it's a lullaby. That might be fine.
Yes. and sometimes, you know, afterwards people will say something specific about what you read. So it can be, it's almost always fun. And
have you found that that's has become kind of an integral part of your writing process, is to make sure that you're then reading aloud the poems or your writing and getting feedback?
The writing group itself, a sort of a typical evening, is that say there are eight people, and that's sort of an average number of people that come. Each of those people would read pass out a copy of what they're going to read so that the others can have something to read and also something to listen to. So the person reads and then the other participants discuss it, sometimes without the writer jumping into the conversation for a few minutes. So it's a critique. I think it's very instructive rather than destructive. It's a friendly group, you know, so it's...
no bad eggs.
No bad eggs.
Yeah, that's good. And, is it open? Can people join the group and if they're interested? Or
yes, and we have run into a little bit of a problem this spring with too many people because we only have 2 hours, so we have sort of quit publicizing this in the newspaper.
Oh well, let's keep it on the hush hush. Then
it's hard to keep it a secret if we've already said it on the air, right? But. But certainly during the summer, you know, the numbers will drop off.
Do you think there's been a resurgence in writing and in people getting involved in it? I mean, certainly with all the online writing and blogs and things like that, there's new avenues for people to get their writing out there.
Well, that's true. I think for the writing group itself, there's nothing that replaces reading to a group of your peers and hearing what they have to say about it.
Do you find it nerve-wracking at times, or is that, or when maybe you first did it, or I could imagine that people would be writing can be such a private mm-hmm. exercise, and then to, especially certain types of writing, and then to, you know, you're sort of throwing yourself out there, but.
But if you want your writing to improve, you can't live completely in a bubble unless you are a true genius. But there won't be any critique at the reading on Sunday. This will be for fun, and there will be quite a range of poetry because there's quite a range of people, from humorous stuff to the natural history to deeply felt emotions and so on. And it's very interesting to listen to a disparate group reading poetry. I like it.
Yeah. It sounds like a wonderful event.
And I would say the first few times that I read aloud, I was almost paralyzed. And I have a lot of experience, you know, with state government talking to people. But this is different, you know. It's very private. And I think the first time I read in Juneau was with the poetry on the bus on the Capitol.
The omnibus. Right.
And so those were very short poems. I think the first one I read was like 4 lines, and I was still very nervous. And
over the sound of the diesel engine and all that stuff, right?
Right. Yeah. And,
Well, so just one more time, remind us of when this is happening and how people can participate. As you said, there's going to be refreshments there. It sounds like a nice thing. I would expect children are welcome to come as well?
It's going to be at the downtown library, and people are welcome, and there will be refreshments, and I think that it will be a good time. So it's from 2 to 4:30, and I imagine the latter part will be mostly refreshments.
Okay, sounds good. Well, thanks so much. That's once again a poetry reading. It's happening this Sunday at the downtown library. Starts at 2:00 and goes to 4:30. Thanks, Sarah and Richard, for coming in.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah.
Make me laugh. Chew!
Gesundheit.
Perseverance Theater and the University of Alaska Southeast present the hilarious comedy The Sneeze, four short plays and four short stories by Anton Chekhov. Directed by Christina Apathy, The Sneeze shows at 7:30 p.m. April 17th through the 19th at the theater in the Hendrickson Building, room 113 on the UAS campus. Tickets at the door. See you at UAS.
Some beautiful music there, and you'll get an opportunity to hear that music coming up on this weekend's Juno Symphony Showcase. And with me in the studio right now, Sally Schlichting is here, Sarah Brown, and Sarah McNair Grove. Thanks so much to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Representing the treble clef, is that what you said? Was that...
Kind of a joke.
That's good. Symphony humor. Always good. Yes. Well, Sally, tell me a little bit about that piece that we got to hear. Yeah.
Sure. That's a flute and clarinet duet that myself and Karen Pallenberg are going to perform. It's by a woman named Lita Greer from Chicago, and it's a very sweet little set of three movements, and Lita Greer composed this piece when she was 16 years old and then arranged it for piano, and it won a big award, and so it's kind of a neat little piece. So.
Wow, yeah. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was I doing when I was 16? Not arranging symphonies, yeah.
Right.
And so you all play instruments, so what instrument do you play?
I'm actually the executive director for the Juno Symphony,
okay.
But
yep.
I'm also singing at this one. So I'm really excited to join my symphony colleagues.
Great.
I'm going to be singing a couple of Handel arias with a 10-piece string ensemble, which will be... fabulous. They're fabulous players. So
yeah, this is called a symphony showcase. So tell me a little bit, what's the idea behind what stuff are you showcasing?
Yeah, it's a chamber concert, and so it's sort of a smorgasbord of several different composers and genres, and it's just the symphony players, they have their favorite pieces they want to present to Juno, so this is their chance to do it. So this is their favorite works that they want to bring to you.
It's an opportunity for us to play chamber music, which... we normally play in the symphony,
okay.
So that's the big deal for us.
And Sarah, the other Sarah, you're a clarinet player.
I'm a clarinet player, and we're playing Richard Strauss' Serenade for 13 Winds, and actually talking about young composers, he was 17 years old when he composed this. So,
those prodigies.
It's a lovely piece, and you have lots of different combinations of the winds that you'll hear sounds. It's got two clarinets, two flutes, oboes, French horns, tubas, bassoons. So it's a neat combination.
Wow, that's
of
a really fun. Yeah. That's a really fun combination. Is there anything else like that that's kind of written for those instruments out there?
Not really that I'm aware of. It's a rather unique combination.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Tell me about what makes a piece something that you particularly enjoy playing.
We first were introduced to this piece about a year ago with Duane Corbin, who's the assistant conductor of the symphony. And it's just a lovely piece, and we thought, if we ever have a chance to play it again, we'd like to do it. And so we thought, here's another chance to have another audience listen to it. It's a lovely piece and just very satisfying to listen to.
Sally, how do you go about picking pieces or coming up with ideas of what types of pieces you want to play?
I listen to a lot of music and get ideas that way, and I hear something, I'm like, oh, God. I want to play that. Or I look for music by certain composers that really interest me that may have written something for, singers or orchestra. And I think, well, did they write anything for chamber music or for flute? And I do a lot of digging and researching and find little gems and like to present those to the Juno audience.
Are there particular people that are involved in the symphony that are sort of like Sally, who are kind of, you know, often bringing ideas? Or,
oh, yeah. Katie Giorgio is bringing David Maslenka's Concerto for Trombone, and it was written with orchestra, but he pared it down to have the orchestration played by piano, and this is actually the premiere of that that arrangement, and it's a really beautiful piece. She'll just be playing the first movement, but then she'll present it again in June. So this is a really rare opportunity to hear, you know, a living composer and a new arrangement of a piece that was written for orchestra and trombone. So yeah come on,
and Katie's
check it out.
A tremendous trombone player too. We're
she
just
is.
Really
She's
so
fabulous.
Fortunate to have her. Yeah.
Well, you know, it is so interesting to kind of, I know Katie, but not through that at all. And, to know people in town, that's probably, you know, sort of the thing that's so cool about the Juno Symphony is that it's just all regular folks who happen to also be very talented.
Yeah.
And this is a way, in this sort of really fun way. Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about how people can get involved or get
sure.
Number one, how can people get involved in the symphony apart from the concert itself?
Oh,
that
wow.
You're doing,
we're always looking for volunteers.
Yes.
We're always looking for players. I mean, if you're interested and you play an instrument and want to join us, you know, shoot us an email at info@junosymphony.org. If you want to be a volunteer, shoot us an email at the same email.
I'm sure there's lots of people out there with a violin or trumpet in closet, you know, that they just haven't quite gotten out in a while, and it seems
absolutely.
Like
absolutely. You know, a lot of audience members come to the performances and they see a full orchestra, so they think, oh, they don't need anybody. But we actually do. We always have a need for more players. Not everybody can play every concert, so it's always nice to have more players that we can reach out to.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah,
I would expect.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
We're a really close knit family.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the concert that's happening and how people can.
Yeah, it's this weekend, Saturday and Sunday. On Saturday, it's at Northern Light United Church at 8 p.m. And on Sunday, it's on the Valley at Aldersgate, next to the movie theater. Tickets are on sale at the Jack or Hearthside Books or on our website at junosymphony.org. Tickets are only $15. So, you know, pretty cheap, you know.
That's cheap for culture.
Bring out your, bring out your husband or wife or partner or whatever and just, or friend and have a good time. Tickets for students are $5, so that's a really good bargain. And it's just a good time and a lovely evening.
And it's you walk away smarter and more culturally aware. Yes.
You're going to have fun. I mean, there's such a variety on this program. And there's a trio, there's a flute trio, there's a great performance by Tim Eyre, who's a local defense attorney, who's going to be playing a piece by Camille Saint-Saëns for tuba and piano.
He
and I are also going to get together and do a flute and tuba duet. You can't miss that. That's just a crazy combination of treble and bass instruments, so it'll be a lot of fun.
All right. Yeah, well, fun will be had by all. It's happening this weekend. One more time, the time.
8 p.m. on Saturday at Northern Light and 3 p.m. on Sunday at Aldersgate.
It's a showcase. It's the Juno Symphony Showcase. Well, Sally, Sarah, and Sarah, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate
it. Thank you.
And have a great, great concert this weekend. We'll hear a little bit more of that piece as we go out here. And that's it for a Juno Afternoon. I want to thank all my guests very much for coming in. Appreciate everyone participating, and hope to see some of you out at all of the great events that are happening this weekend. Happy Earth Day, everyone.
Not stop a global economy at our shores. We've got to be in there and compete.
President Obama and Senate Republicans work to give him authority to negotiate a big trade bill.
It's Friday, April 17th, and this is All Things Considered.
I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Audie Cornish. Coming up, that legislation would allow for a big Pacific regional trade bill.